The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Today we begin a new series called The Conspiracy Files as News Talk Simon Tierney joins us to investigate everything from the assassination of Martin Luther King to those who believe that Elvis is still alive and what drives people to propagate these ideas. For the first installment of the series, we're going back in time to New Mexico in the 1940s. The collective American imagination has been consumed with the idea of little green men for over 70 years, inspiring countless movies, books, TV shows. But the conspiracy theories surrounding UFOs, flying saucers, and extraterrestrial beings owe much of their origins to a small town in New Mexico called Roswell. The events that took place in a farmer's field near that town in 1947 have sparked intrigue for decades. News Talk reporter Simon Tierney has been investigating, and he joins me now. Simon, good morning. Simon, how did the world first hear about the events at Roswell?
Good morning, Pat. An extraordinary radio bulletin was broadcast on a show called Headline Edition on ABC, the American Broadcasting Company, on July the 8th, 1947, one which I can only imagine must have filled post-war listeners with both bemusement and terror simultaneously. Have a listen to this.
Headline Edition, July 8th, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
It's a pretty startling report, but it made it clear to the listening public that some sort of unidentified flying object or flying disc had been recovered. But what exactly did happen at Roswell?
So on June the 14th, 1947, a 48-year-old New Mexico farmer by the name of Mac Brazel was driving across his land when he stumbled across a heap of unusual debris, shall we call it that, which appeared to have crashed into the ground, Pat. He described it as a large area of bright wreckage made up of rubber strips, tinfoil, and rather tough paper and sticks. And it was said to be about 20 feet in diameter. It had a small beam with purple-hued hieroglyphics and some adhesive tape with images of flowers on it. And he was baffled by it, but he paid it rather scant attention at first, and it wasn't until 3 weeks later, on July the 4th, that he gathered up the detritus, bundled it into the back of his truck, and drove it down to the nearest town, which was Roswell, about 100 kilometres south. But why did he do this? That's the key question, really, Pat, because if he hadn't bothered showing it to anyone, then the story would never have developed.
I suppose to try and understand why Brazel decided to bring it to the world's attention, we have to try to understand the political and cultural context of late 1940s America.
This is crucial, Pat. World War II had, of course, just finished 2 years previously, but a major new concern was on the horizon, the Cold War. There was a legitimate fear that America may end up in a war of annihilation with the Soviet Union. And this caused people to be nervous, especially as the newsreels at the time were filled with fear-mongering over the new atomic age. And couple this with the widely publicised sightings by Kenneth Arnold earlier in 1947. He had claimed to have witnessed the passage of what he described as 9 shiny and metallic unidentified flying objects in Washington State. And he described them as flying saucers. And in doing so, he became the first person to use that term. Brazel would have been aware of this story, Pat, and indeed many others that were circulating at the time. So it was in this frenzied atmosphere that the Roswell incident finds itself being played out. People were on high alert, but they were also perhaps predisposed to believing things which they may previously not have accepted so readily.
And this is the key to understanding this phenomenon of conspiracy theories.
I think it is. They're a product very much of the culture in which they emerge. This is why we see perhaps parallels between this period we're discussing today and the presidency of Donald Trump, which was rife with conspiracy theories. Trump consistently gave legitimacy to them during his tenure, as we well remember. Most damagingly, perhaps that of QAnon, which we'll be discussing later in this series. Conspiracy theories they are seductive. And I've really noticed that as I've been researching them, Pat, for this series. They offer answers to people who live in uncertain times, people who have a growing distrust of the world, of government. And for this reason, it's no coincidence that, I suppose, the Cold War ignited a new age of conspiracy theories.
President Truman's dramatic announcement that Russia has created an atomic explosion sends reporters racing for Flushing Meadow, where Russia's Vyshinsky arrives to address the United Nations.
Mr. Vyshinsky, have you got any statement about
it? In a grim new age of warfare, today's fighting men must be taught survival on an atomic battlefield. Demonstrating the importance of civil defense preparedness, the elaborate exercises proved survival is possible, offering new hope to all who live in the shadow of the atomic age.
In Washington, ghost-like objects dart across the radar screen at the CAA Traffic Control Center at National Airport for several hours, traveling more than 100 miles an hour. Air Force jet fighters spend several hours chasing the objects plotted on the radar scope.
They seem to flip and flash in the sun just like a mirror. And in fact, I happen to be at an angle from the sun that seemed to hit the tops of these peculiar-looking things in such a way that it almost blinded you when you looked at them through your plexiglass windshield. I'd be glad to confirm it with my hands on a Bible, because I did see it, and whether it has anything to do with our army or our intelligence or whether it has to do with some foreign country, I don't know. But I did see it, and I did clock it, and I just happened to be in a beautiful position to do it.
87 ships take positions 3 miles off Bikini to suffer the shattering impact of the fifth atomic bomb. Here will be tested the capacity of modern armament to withstand the crushing shock of compressed water traveling a mile per second. It's a graphic record of one of the most terrifying happenings in world events.
Well, it sounds like a world on the brink. In the context of this frenetic atmosphere then, what did Mr. Brazel do with the bizarre wreckage that he found strewn across his ranch?
So Brazel handed the collection to the sheriff of Roswell. The sheriff was perplexed too, and he contacted the local army base in Roswell. This is very important that there was quite a large army base in Roswell. And they sent one of their intelligence officers over to inspect the debris, Pat. His name was Major Jesse Marcel, a man who would go on to play a very influential role in the mythology of the Roswell incident. And after reviewing the material, he decided to make a rather strange statement to the press when he declared that a flying disc had indeed landed in Brazel's field.
Why would a high-level intelligence officer with the US Army say something so inflammatory?
Well, some scholars believe that Marcel was willing to say anything in order to cover up the truth of what the debris actually was. Others believe that he was sincere in his conviction that it was an alien object. But the following day, an official correction was made rather abruptly to Marcel's blunder, and it was announced that the wreckage was actually a crashed weather balloon. And this was the resolution that put the story to bed, for the time being at least.
Okay, so the story actually lay dormant for over 30 years until there was renewed interest in the late 1970s. And I suppose it was from this period that a new craze for UFOs began.
Indeed, Pat. The Roswell incident was resurrected in the late 70s, as you say, and it hasn't really subsided since. And this happened because of a number of key events. Firstly, a nuclear physicist by the name of Stanton Friedman, I should say, spent years investigating the incident, and he was convinced that the US government had engaged in a sort of cosmic cover-up, and then he lectured around the world on the subject. Secondly, the National Enquirer resurrected the story while conveniently omitting the crucial correction about the weather balloon. Then a documentary called UFOs Are Real was aired on US television in 1979. You can imagine from the title of that program what the editorial leanings were. And in the show, Major Jesse Marcel, this character who keeps turning up in this story, now an old man, he was interviewed and he revealed the depths of his suspicions about what he discovered at Roswell when he was brought out to Brazel's ranch in the summer of 1947 to inspect the bizarre wreckage.
One thing I was certain of, being familiar with all air activities, that it was not a weather balloon, nor an aircraft, nor a missile. It was something else of which we didn't know what it was. There were just fragments strewn all over the area, an area about 3/4 of a mile long and several hundred feet wide. So we proceeded to pick up the parts. A lot of it had a lot of little members with symbols that, to me, I call them hieroglyphics because I could not interpret them. It could not be read. They were just like symbols of something that meant something. These little members could not be broken, could not be burned. I even tried to burn that. It would not burn. See, that stuff weighs nothing. It's not any thicker than tinfoil in a pack of cigarettes. Says, I tried to bend the stuff. Says, it will not bend. Says, we did all we could to bend it. It would not bend.
And that was Major Jesse Marcel speaking in 1979. Things took an even more bizarre turn when a mortician, an undertaker from Roswell, came forward with fresh testimony.
Yeah, this is when the conspiracy theory really begins to inflate, Pat. In the 1980s, a mortician, as you said, from a funeral home in Roswell, named Glenn Davis, came forward to offer an extraordinary new insight into the events. He claimed that he had a friend who worked as a lieutenant nurse at the Roswell Army Air Force Base, and that she'd come to him to reveal that three extraterrestrial bodies had been recovered from the wreckage. Let's listen to what he had to say.
She said, well, you won't believe it. And she says, I don't believe it either. But she said, I got in a lot of trouble on this thing. She said, we have three bodies. There was three bodies. She said two of them were very mutilated. And she explained they were like 3.5 feet to 4 feet tall. The heads were somewhat larger than a human heads. The hands were long, no thumbs. It was just the long, very delicate fingers at the end of the, on the underside at the tip of each fingers was a pad-like, maybe a little pad, but it looked like the skin had maybe a little suction, like the little suction cups on those. On the, no fingernails on the hands. There was no teeth. It was the inside of the mouth. It was kind of like a real, a gums. Maybe it was, she said, explain it. It was almost as hard as if it was rawhide, maybe, at that. The ears, there was only two small orifices on each side of the head with looked like a couple of small lobes that might. And also that the nose, there was only two small orifices in the nose.
Was she emotional about all this?
Very much so. Very emotional. She would have to stop and drink water. And wringing her hands, and she said it was the most horrified. I've never been so horrified in my life. I've never seen anything so gruesome in my life. I've never smelt anything that smelt worse in my life.
That was mortician Glenn Davis giving his version of events. Now, the story of Roswell came full circle in the mid-1990s, Simon. The US government finally responded to the endless conspiracy theories.
They did, Pat. In 1994, it was a congressman from New Mexico by the name of Stephen Schiff insisted on answers from the government because basically he was being questioned so often by his constituents. And a statement was released which revealed a cover-up, but not the one that ufologists were hoping for, perhaps. It turned out that it was indeed a balloon, but not one for detecting weather. Instead, it was actually a specialised high-altitude balloon that was part of a top-secret US spy program called Project Mogul, much of which operated out of Roswell Army Air Force Base. And the balloons were designed to detect reverberations from Soviet nuclear test activity. Now, in 1947, it was the beginning, of course, of the Cold War, and the government was willing to do anything to cover up their spy program on the Soviets. But by 94, the Clinton years, the Soviet Union had collapsed, and the time seemed right, I suppose, to reveal the truth.
But despite this pretty credible explanation, Roswell continues to mystify the American public, and various presidents have been hounded for answers on the topic over the years, I believe.
It's extraordinary. I mean, everyone from George Bush to Donald Trump have had to field questions on the subject. And what I found in my research, Pat, of various pieces of archive footage is that the more they deny and obfuscate, the more intrigue it breeds with theorists. When Donald Trump, for example, was president, he issued an order which which conspiracy theorists are hoping will shed new light on the matter. This is to be a report on quote-unquote unidentified aerial phenomena and will be published sometime before June of this year. So very soon we're expecting that report. Will it put the conspiracy theories to bed or will it inspire yet more intrigue? I would bet on the latter. The American appetite, seemingly, for these stories is insatiable.
When you were in office, and I don't know when this happened or if it happened, did you go through the secret files, the UFO documents? Because if I was president, that'd be the first thing I did.
You know, it's funny. My daughters asked the very same question.
They did?
Yeah.
Would you be allowed to tell your daughters what was in those files?
No.
You would not?
No.
Now that you're out of office, you can do anything you want, right?
True, yeah. But I'm not telling you.
You're not telling me. You're not telling me what? Are you not telling me that you looked at them?
I'm not telling you nothing.
It's at the
top aliens
of my
won't
list.
Let it happen. You reveal all their secrets. They exercise strict control over us.
Now, you know, there are a lot of people that are going to examine your facial expressions here, every twitch, everything, and say, and of course, so did you look? Did you see? Did you explore?
I can't reveal anything.
Oh, really? Because President Clinton said he did go right in and he did check and there was nothing.
Well, you know, that's what we're instructed to say.
Would you ever open up Roswell and let us know what's really going on there?
So many people ask me that question.
I know, it sounds almost ridiculous, but it's actually the real question.
It sounds like a cute question, but it's actually, there are millions and millions of people that want to go there, that want to see it. I won't talk to you about what I know about it, but it's very interesting. But Roswell's a very interesting place with a lot of people that would like to know what's going on.
So you're saying you may declassify, no. you'll take it?
Well, I'll have to think about that one, right?
Donald Trump teasing the American public, of course, a great fan, as he is, of conspiracy theories. The other two presidents talking to Jimmy Kimmel, having a bit of fun with it, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Well, Simon, thank you for that report. And Simon will be back at the same time next week when we continue our new series, which is called The Conspiracy Files, here on News Talk.